All right, so first of all, there's nothing like a good typo to break up the solemnity of the Dharma talk. So here's my greeting to you. It says, good evening, Bodhisattvas. It seems like the Williams poem has spoken to at least a few of you, so I'm hoping spending some more time with it tonight will feel like it adds another tributary to the flow of the retreat and mingles with it. What I want to bring the poem to bear on this evening is that odd jump, for me anyway, in the koan from inconsolable grief to hearing a deer cry, being asked, where is that deer? And then especially hearing the teacher shout, being asked, who hears? And then we don't hear anything more explicitly about Mujaka's grief. But before I get to the poem, I've realized listening to Megan and Andrew and Sarah talk about the koan that I'm hearing something a little different in Bukko's shout, or at least that I want to emphasize something a little different about it. I also hear the deer's cry of, I also hear in the deer's cry of pain or grief something Sarah, if I remember right, said about the teacher's shout, how raw and intensely alive it is. I hear grief in the teacher's shout too, but that's not all. We know that a teacher's teisho, which is traditionally a direct presentation of Dharma or Tao rather than a commentary about it, literally means presentation of the shout. And those Rinzai shouts of yours, supposedly, and maybe our own shouts too, feel like they come right up out of the ground, out of emptiness or the source, bursting into form and life with a force that supposedly knocked people down or deafened them or struck them dead. Reviving them again was another important piece of a teacher's toolkit. Let's say that's a myth. It still tells us something about the shout. Suzuki Roshi, at a memorial service for his beloved student Trudy Dixon, reportedly gave a shout of immense grief. Before he did so, he said something strange, something like, now I express the full extent of my power. So I think his shout of grief was also a shout of complete affirmation, saying yes to all of it, letting it all rush right through him and find expression. The way I hear it, Bukko's shout joins Mujaku in her grief, but also confronts her with something that might have felt startling, disconcerting, even abrasive. This shout of life and affirmation rubbing right up against her grief. I think she carries that with her down to the stream, and in some ways the koan is the story of how she's changed by that jarring encounter. Since it's a koan, we don't get many details about how she begins to work with or process this moment. That's where the poem comes in. It doesn't give us a sequence that matches the koan point for point, but it does slow down and attend to the speaker's psychology, the way something like Mujaku's struggles might play out over time. The poem also explores something like the matter of two hearts Megan brought up Monday night. Our own particular heart with its intense and specific griefs and joys, and the big heart of the Heart Sutra, the vastness, the world teeming with life and death and change. Not identical, not one, that's really important, but also not two. How might it feel when they rub up against each other, and how might things begin to shift when they do? Okay then. A woman walks into a bar, sits down and says, sorrow is my own yard. Or a woman says that to her pastor or her therapist or her Zen teacher or her friend.
What does she say?
Sorrow is my own yard. All right. Says sorrow is my own yard to a Zen teacher or a friend or in a bar. All right. How to say what we hear in that somewhat peculiar phrase? It's wrenching and intense, but also maybe a little insistent in its sweeping claim, its quality of defining something. What's my own yard to me? It's nothing but sorrow. It's kind of like Andrew's first category of question, the pointed one that invites a pointed answer that points back at the one who asked, confirming what the question thought it meant. Then, as Andrew also said, there's the kind of question that asks, what is this, I wonder, where not knowing is most intimate, and we feel our way into that intimacy and that unknown terrain. We're not there yet. But I'm suggesting that sorrow is my own yard, and its insistence might be pushing back against or fending off a sense that this familiar definition doesn't quite define the whole terrain anymore. Not something easy to let in, especially in a circumstance as intense and freighted as this one. I don't think we're too far from practice here. How can we get better at hearing the stories we tell about ourselves in ways that allow them to loosen and begin to shift? In part by listening carefully to our own language. If, for instance, you hear yourself saying, "Sorrow is my own yard," it's time to pay attention with what we sometimes call warm curiosity. In the poem, this kind of shift doesn't happen right away, and when it does, she doesn't do it all by herself, which also sounds like our practice. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. In the poem's next few lines, I still hear something of that insistent quality, as of a real and intense grief held onto tightly as permanent home. Here are the lines. "Sorrow is my own yard, where the new grass flames as it has flamed often before, but not with the cold fire that closes round me this year." That sudden flames is startling and intense, just as the grass shooting up suddenly startles the speaker with the intensity of its new life springing into being. It also seems painful and dangerous, a fire leaping up. But cold fire, it doesn't warm her or shift anything for her. Maybe. And then closes round, feels final. It won't let anything in. Cold fire might suggest a similar finality, a turning away, a refusal. But the strange phrase also seems to describe a strange and uncomfortable sensation, unsettled and unsettling, as if her own body feels out of sync with itself, as if something were starting to change her very bones, we might say. It reminds me of Megan's guided meditation yesterday morning, how to pay attention to something like that. Here's what's next. "35 years I lived with my husband." That's like a summation, and it closes the book, or a book. But for me, it's hard to know how to hear it, how to hear her tone, as she hovers among contradictory feelings. In that unsettled, unresolved quality, maybe she moves toward not knowing. 35 years I lived with my husband. This was my life, and now that life is over. My own life is over? What is my heart right now? And which heart will answer, and for whom? This feels like a bad moment for a detour, but I'm going to risk a short one. I'm just getting to the good part of the poem.
Yeah. You know? There we go.
Stay tuned next week. Next week's Dharma Talk. There's a great passage in Emerson about how the world feels in the midst of intense bereavement. I want to quote it and riff off it a bit. It probably sounds a little strange on first hearing. "Nature always wears the colors of the spirit. There is a kind of contempt of the landscape felt by him who has just lost by death a dear friend. The sky is less grand as it shuts down over less worth in the population." Less worth in the population. There's a mordant quality here that barely conceals a deep tenderness, maybe even awe. The world as if drained, stripped bare, emptied out. Here's the riff based on my own experience. That drained world, emptied out, can also feel empty in our sense. Each living creature and each solid thing, more fragile and evanescent, more tender. And strangely, out of that, another aspect of emptiness can also flare up, flaming as it were. To the grieving body and spirit, tender and fragile, things can also seem suddenly intently alive and intensely present, exactly themselves, impinging on us with a particular startling sharpness. It's painful, thin-skinned as we are, but it's also painful because we want to let it in, as in the poem Abruptly. The plum tree is white today with masses of flowers. Masses of flowers load the cherry branches and color some bushes yellow and some red. This feels unexpected for the speaker, I think, and if you're reading the poem for the first time. We're not so far from practice here, maybe especially our practice in retreat, as we get porous and things impinge on us or flow through us with unexpected immediacy. In this passage, it's partly the profusion of colors bursting through the monochrome of Sorrow is My Own Yard that registers her unanticipated engagement. The red is not the yellow, Yuan Wu says somewhere in the Blue Cliff Record. I think he actually used different colors, but I had to use the colors of the poem. The red is not the yellow. But there's something else. Repeated and followed by load the cherry branches, masses registers the heft, the burgeoning profusion of blossoms sagging the branches down a little, a weightiness that's not a burden, but a delight. Can you feel it? What if you held out your arms, branch-like, the gift of that heft in your arms? They sag a little bit, don't they? I think the widow feels it right here, as it were, in her body. As if she were the trees is a little too strong, maybe, but if not one, then not two either. So what she sees triggers an experience of weight and movement, loading, sagging, that's primarily tactile. Where are the trees? Right here in my body and my heart. Where is that deer? Who hears? The Coens are full of such moments, sight or hearing sliding into an imagined but palpable sensation of motion, kinetic rhythm, texture, and phantom touch. And touch is intimate, and in Chan, the character for intimate is one way to write enlightenment. Which, by the way, might help explain the show-me bugaboo in Work in the Room. No, we're not playing charades, and you don't have to be as good a mime as Marcel Marceau, but the Coen and the world are right here in your own body and your own heart. I remember a talk by Geraldine up in California where she said, show me were the two scariest words in the English language. Mini detour two. In the open source, we're interested in fostering a Zen that acknowledges the ancient ancestors in part by rediscovering them in our own culture and its traditions. So I want to explore what's happening in this part of the poem by turning to a couple of short quotations from the romantic poet John Keats. What Zen offers, the Soto teacher and poet Norman Fisher says, is a method. But in lots of other ways, he says too, the terrain it explores is pretty similar to what we can find in our own poetries and wisdom traditions. First, Keats's version of the intimacy of not knowing, into which the widow has more or less slipped. I mean negative capability, that is, when a person is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. In this moment in the poem, the speaker isn't reaching, irritably or otherwise, for her story, or trying to reason what she sees into fitting into that settled narrative. Next, here's an instance of what for Keats can happen in that state of not knowing or negative capability. Or if a sparrow come before my window, I take part in its existence and pick about the gravel. In the porosity of not knowing, not buffering what's present by running it through our settled categories or stories, I feel the sparrows picking right here in my body, or the heft of the blossom-filled branches. Keats pulls these aspects together in the figure of what he calls the chameleon poet, an ideal figure who would have no fixed conceptions or self-conceptions, and who would be particularly liable to being washed over by intense identifications. As to the poetical character itself, he says, it is not itself. It has no self. It is everything and nothing, It has no character. A poet is the most unpoetical of anything in existence because he has no identity. He is continually in for and filling some other body. To put it a little differently, it's as if the chameleon poet dissolves into and moves through the circuit of forms, circulating through the emptiness and interpermeation of beings. Or in this no longer logical space, as if the circuit of forms circulates through him. I know that Sarah, in the Lanka classes you held a while ago at SMS, talked about the sutra's perhaps surprising assertion that Tathagatas have Tathagata bodies. They've changed their very bones. I suppose those Tathagata bodies are capable of astral projection and lots of other wonders I have not experienced. But I think Keats's chameleon poet, sliding through beings or sliding beings through himself, is at least a junior Birdman Tathagata. Be that as it may, we're not too far here as the speaker feels the heft of the blossoms filling her arms, from Where Is That Deer, or the shout, or Who Is Hearing, and the opening they set in motion. By contrast, it's not so clear in this moment that Sorrow Is My Own Yard is a wholly adequate summation of where we are. What is my grief becoming now, the speaker might ask. The heart of the one who asks is Zen. Which heart is it? Not one and not two. But what happens next feels wholly human. But the grief in my heart is stronger than they, for though they were my joy formerly, today I notice them and turn away forgetting. I think there's a kind of inverted logic or a psychological sleight of hand at work here. Because I notice them but turn away forgetting, I know that the grief in my heart is stronger than this new feeling. So I'm back home in my separate body and this now familiar place where sorrow is my own yard. Except for that funny thing, the elephant in the room. It's not I noticed or I turned, past tense. It's present tense. I notice them and turn away forgetting. So, I'm not thinking about the elephant in the room right now. I'm not noticing these masses of flowers that load the cherry blossoms. I'm forgetting them right now. Meaning in its contradiction, forget them right now. A command or a heart-rending plea. Isn't that how it is, Joan used to say in Work in the Room with a quiet laugh. I suspect there are a lot of entries in everyone's lifetime retreat diary pretty much like this. We start to slide out into the chameleon body along the circuit of forms and pull back. In my experience, a lot of times it's out of fear, but also sometimes from a sense of something like guilt that from another vantage seems bizarre. I don't deserve this. I'm not a good enough person to experience this great joy. In the speaker's case, the guilt, if that's what it is, seems less surprising. How can I turn away from my grief and from my beloved husband, seduced by new life into such disloyalty? The phrasing makes this either-or struggle palpable, almost like a bodily sensation of being pulled back. The grief in my heart is stronger than they. I turn away, it pulls me away when I was turning towards. It's good that we get to go on more than one retreat, and I'm glad this isn't the end of the poem. What happens next is something the speaker can't do for herself. The trees in her yard have already begun to fetch her. Now her son comes to her aid. He doesn't tell her how to fix things, but he accompanies her, an intimate companion. He accompanies her by leaving her alone. But he offers her a field into which she might wander, something he saw that becomes for her a kind of dream image that draws her in a reverie in which the landscape continues to take shape around her. She makes the road by walking it in imagination, feeling her way as I hear it towards some possible resolving and release. We could also call this her awakening, actual or incipient. Today my son told me that in the meadows, at the edge of the heavy woods, in the distance, he saw trees of white flowers. I feel that I would like to go there and fall into those flowers and sink into the marsh near them. It's hard to know how to be tactful here, pulled partly toward a clinical literalism that isn't quite legit, since she's an imaginary person with no existence other than the specifics the poem lends her, and pulled in the opposite direction toward reading the poem as a koan, which it isn't quite. But let's go down each of those paths at least a little. Department of Real Living Persons. This doesn't feel 911 ready to me, in part because it's so conspicuously imagined and conjectural, in a drawn-out, feeling-her-way along the contours of a dream sort of way. She imagines a kind of liminal, initiatory space. The sun sees something at the edge of a woods, which the speaker seems to respond to as a symbolic threshold, a zone of possible transformation. And she says the woods are heavy, a slightly odd word. Thick with trees, yes, but also like something out of a fairy tale. And she enters this transformative space tentatively, as if it would take shape around her as she inched toward it, feeling her way toward a vision of possible opening. At the edge, in the distance, I feel that I would like to go there. Here's a funny thing. A crucial part of what provokes this reverie is something her son tells her he saw that's pretty similar to what she's just seen and forgotten right in her own yard, trees of white flowers. It's as if she's circled back, revisiting a gift the world has already brought her that she wasn't quite ready to accept, feeling her way into it. What are those flowers? What is it to move toward them? In her reverie, the flowers have fallen to the ground, caught up in a process she brings into the story, embellishing what her son said. How many? Well, enough to fall into, to hold her as she falls, to cushion or pillow her, a place of profusion and growth in which she might rest. There's something incredibly soft, gentle, tender in this image of process. Sink into, in this dream context, is like melting into. In her yard, the flowers seem intensely themselves, tathagata. Here's another aspect, dissolving and interpermeation. If we're reading as amateur clinicians, the poem's final line might feel rather more bleak, and sink into the marsh near them, an image of death and decay. But here it feels, at least to me, less like a plan for ending her life than an acknowledgement and letting in of the inclusive, inescapable undoing that will take in everything, including her and everything she loves. First, we get to enjoy the feast. I remember Susan Murphy saying in a Dharma talk, "Then we are the feast." I think it matters that the last two lines present dream images that are not exactly sequential. It's not first the joy of the flowers, and then, blub, blub, the grim truth hiding underneath them. Instead, they're spatialized, two visions imagined as next to each other, side by side, and fall into those flowers, and sink into the marsh near them. So it's not, as it felt to her in her yard, either or, the pull of the springtime profusion of flowers, but the grief in my heart is stronger than they. It's and, both and, or even, as some second language speakers of English say, same, same. To fall into the profusion of flowers is to fall into the marsh, and to fall into the marsh is to enter the circuit of forms and rediscover the heft of the flowers, heartbreakingly beautiful. Turning toward one isn't turning away from the other. Sorrow is my own yard, is also the burgeoning blossoms. It's good to be careful here and not grab too fast at an extractable moral, running headlong toward the Great Circle of Life and the Lion King movies, which actually weren't too bad. But I think what this dream image opens up into is something that was already there in her yard, in the branches loading the cherry trees, weighing them down. To fall into the circuit of forms and slide along them, or to pass them through your body, is to enter a space that is simultaneously evanescent, everything fragile and fleeting and mortal, and full of that strangely eternal quality that Zen can show us, a vast stillness in which everything is both living and dead, or neither living nor dead. Here's Norman Fisher's formulation. You and I are already dead. We think later we'll be dead, but that's baloney. Actually, right now, in each breath, we're alive and we're dead. We don't know that, and that's why we're suffering. Actually, every morning, every day, we should be in mourning. Every moment, we should be mourning. Grief and elegy are right here, with the burgeoning flowers filling and loading your arms, the ponderosas and blossoms along the path, the streams. No need to turn toward or turn from. Almost done. Here's Joan from Invisible Ceremonies. Grief is a form of love, how we go on loving in the absence of the beloved. It is the transformation of love through loss and how we are initiated into a new world. And the woman in the story, whose name is Mujaku, went on to accomplish great things, helping other women meet their own hearts. This is still Joan. Generations of nuns wrote poems about her. One said that the water from her bucket filled many puddles. She was able to do this not because she found a way around her grief, but because she went quiet inside and listened for what grief was asking of her. Her cry for help, the cry of the deer, moonlight pouring from a broken bucket, her grief spread further than the edges of her skin, belonged to more than her particular heart, and so did her awakening. As she was held, so could she hold. That is what awakening is. Here's another koan. One day Changsha went off to wander in the mountains. When he returned, the director of the temple met him at the gate and asked, "Where have you been?" "I've been out strolling about the hills." "Which way did you go?" "I went out following the scented grasses and came back chasing the falling flowers." "That's exactly the feeling of spring," said the director. "It's better than autumn dew falling on the lotuses," said Changsha. Shuido said, "I'm grateful for your reply." Thank you.